Oh, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dave Deptula, Dean of the Mitchell Institute of Aerospace Studies, and welcome to our Aerospace Nation series. We're really pleased today that Lieutenant General Jim Slife could join us today. General Slife is the commander of Air Force Special Operations Command. And as the commander of the air component of U.S. Special Operations Command, General Slife manages the organization and worldwide deployment of approximately 21,000 Air Force Special Operations professionals. He's a command pilot with more than 3,100 flight hours in the MH-53, MQ-1, and other various aircraft. So welcome, General Slife, and thanks very much for taking the time today. What I'd like to do is start off our session today by giving you an opportunity to make a few opening remarks on the critical challenges that your team is facing and some of your top priorities as you look to the future. So over to you.
Hey, thanks, General Deptula. It's good to see you again, and it's good to have the opportunity to join the virtual audience here on Aerospace Nation. You've really done a great job managing this platform and keeping the conversation fresh each and every episode of this. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to join you and talk a little bit about the Air Force Special Operations Command and where we are and where we're going. You know, I would say that in general, like the rest of the DoD, we find ourselves at a strategic inflection point that is unlike anything that really we have seen since September 11th of 2001. And although you couldn't probably put a thumbtack on a calendar and say, this is the day that great power competition became our primary focus, I think you'd have to acknowledge that this is where we are in the strategic environment. And so like everybody else, we're having to think about what that means. And you know, AFSOC really reinvented itself after September 11th. AFSOC had been a force that was largely geared to short-term crisis response and contingency operations, and was generally used to serving a supporting role to the broader joint force. And after September 11th, both of those things changed. We got into a sustained contingency mindset where we've had squadrons deployed for the better part of 20 years without a break. And we had to re-gear ourselves to operate in that environment. We had to re-gear ourselves in many ways to be the supported force, certainly for the counter VEO fight, in a way that was somewhat unfamiliar to us. And so all these changes took place because the AFSOC that we had was not the AFSOC that we needed. And so we needed to become something fundamentally different. And frankly, we have. But when we look at where we are at this strategic inflection point, and we look forward another decade or decade and a half, I think we have to acknowledge that the AFSOC that we have is not the AFSOC that we will need in the future. And so we have to go about another transformation effort. And the thing that makes this, I think, so difficult is, in general, I would say the hardest thing for any organization to do is transform in the aftermath of success. And when you look back at the last 20 years, this has been, you know, a very soft-centric era. And AFSOC has benefited greatly from the experiences and the focus over the last 20 years. And so, you know, the tempting challenge to many of us would be to say, hey, we have just had, you know, 20 years of unalloyed success. Why would we possibly change? And, you know, this is the challenge facing all of us. And the analogy that I use in talking to the force is, hey, you know, we're the film industry in 1996. You know, in 1996, Kodak was coming off of over 100 years of profit. They had created generational wealth for shareholders and employees alike for 100 plus years. And yet they saw the future coming. They knew that digital imaging was coming. They weren't stupid. They recognized it. But by 2011, Kodak was bankrupt. Kodak's primary competitor in 1996 was Fuji. In 2021, Fuji is still a profitable company. And so what's the difference? And the difference is that Fuji was able to successfully envision themselves in this future environment and pivot around their competitive strengths in order to get to that that future environment in a way that kept them competitive. Kodak was not able to make that transformation. And so in AFSOC, we are at, you know, it's 1996 and we're in the film business. And so, you know, the first thing we've had to do is figure out what is it that we have to pivot around? What is our competitive advantage for the future? And in AFSOC, it's simple. Our competitive advantage are our airmen. Our airmen are our competitive advantage. And so we've laid out our strategy for transformation built around three major lines of effort that focus on our airmen and how we're going to enable the airmen of tomorrow to be relevant and capable in that future operating environment. So I look forward to talking about that with you a little bit today, General Deptula, and fielding your questions, maybe exploring some of that where it's of interest to you. So thanks very much again for the opportunity to join you today.
Well, that's super. Thanks very much for that context and insight, and also for all that your team's doing to enable our Air Force to be ready for special operations around the globe. So as you suggest, let's dig a bit deeper into some of the topics that you raised. Now, the Air Force is likely to face a prolonged period of budget constraints in the years to come. And you've previously stated the need to carefully consider systems and equipment better suited for near-peer competition. Looking ahead to FY22 and beyond, how is AFSOC prioritizing its resources in this emerging strategic and budgetary environment?
Yeah, thanks. That is the central challenge facing us. And as you well know, when you go around and talk to commanders and airmen at echelons, there's no shortage of good ideas about what we ought to be doing and what we ought to do more of. There is a relative scarcity of ideas of what we need to stop doing. And that is, the challenge facing us is how do we invest in the things that only we can do? And so that's kind of the first lens that I look at is what are the things that only AFSOC can do for the broader joint force? There are things that perhaps for various reasons we could go into if it's of interest that we find ourselves in 2021 performing what I would consider commodity activities, things that other people do. And, you know, we may like the way we do them better than other people. We may think we're the best in the world at them. But at the end of the day, if it's not a unique part of what we bring to the joint force, then we really need to carefully consider whether we need to be staying in that line of work. The analogy that I use in talking about this with the force is, you know, sometimes when it's time for dinner, you go into the kitchen and you open the refrigerator and you open the cupboard and you look at the ingredients you have and you decide what you can make for dinner with the ingredients that you have available. Sometimes you know exactly what you want for dinner, and so you just go to the grocery store and buy the groceries that you need. And I would say that we are in an era, as you described, with the budgetary environment and so forth, we're probably in an environment where we need to look in the kitchen to see what we have available and go to the grocery store only for those ingredients and spices and condiments that maybe will round out the meal that we're going to have tonight, but maybe not completely replace all the groceries we have in the cupboard. And so we have some great capabilities in AFSOC that just maybe need a little bit of work, a little bit of tactics development in order to be relevant for the future operating environment. But our cupboard and our refrigerator have got some groceries in them. We just need to think about how we're going to make the meal that is going to be required for the future.
I have to tell you, that's the first time I've heard that analogy. And I think it's a good one. I'll tell you why it's a good one is because it allows those outside the military, and you spoke very well in non-jargonese, to understand some of the challenges. So keep that up. Now, you previously served as the commander of the 27th Special Operations Group, which includes AFSOC's primary remotely piloted aircraft squadrons. As always, there's a debate today in Washington over the future utility of RPAs against near-peer competitors. What would you say has been the lasting effect of remotely piloted aircraft on AFSOC ops? And what's been AFSOC's role in transforming the RPA into the formidable system that it is today?
Yeah, this is a community that I've got a pretty big spot in my heart for. I don't know that you know this, but I believe, I certainly assert it, that I am the Air Force's senior RPA pilot. When I was the ops group commander at Cannon, I checked out and flew the MQ-1 operationally. And I did that because it was new to us at the time, and there was no senior leaders in AFSOC that understood the very, very unique aspects of how you operate this platform. As you well know from your experience, this is not, you know, something where you can just translate what we grew up doing, flying airplanes, to the RPA force. And so somebody needed to understand this. And so I took it upon myself to kind of dive into this. And I would tell you that, you know, for SOF, again, prior to 9/11, we were really geared towards crisis response. And so we didn't necessarily have a need for long dwell ISR and, you know, the types of capabilities that as we moved into a counter VEO fight, counterinsurgency, these types of operations, the enormous requirement for intelligence to pace our operations was something that we had not previously considered. And so I think now that we have figured out how to integrate RPAs and ISR more broadly into our operational cycle, I don't see that we will ever go back. Now, I don't know that the MQ-9 is the platform for the future. It certainly has a place condiment or a, you know, piece of food in the kitchen, but I don't know that it will be a central part of what we're going to be doing in the future. But RPAs and the ISR mission more broadly are here to stay, I would tell you for sure. And to the latter part of your question, how has AFSOC facilitated this? You know, we have been able to benefit from SOCOM soft peculiar funding to pioneer capabilities and tactics with the RPA force that have then been broadly proliferated across the rest of the Air Force enterprise. And I think there's a lot of value to that model where AFSOC can serve as a pathfinder for the rest of the Air Force in a host of areas. And there are other examples of that. Certainly we have done that with the RPA force, really to the benefit of the whole joint force, not just to SOF.
Well, I applaud you for doing that, for getting checked out in the airplane as a senior officer. I'm awfully proud of the fact that I was fully combat mission qualified in the F-15 in every rank from lieutenant to lieutenant general. And that, you know, as you now understand, as you get more and more senior in rank, you tend to get more and more isolated from the folks who are on the at the tip of the spear. So I think there's a lot of value for senior officers to be able to be checked out in the systems over which they participate, because you then garner insights and can also share insights with those at the lower levels. So well done in that regard. Now, Jim, you know this, but the audience may not. I first got to know you when you were a major in 2002, when you were working on a book about General Bill Creech, in which you chronicled the transformation of Tactical Air Command following the Vietnam War. As the Air Force transitions to meeting threats posed by pacing and peer competitors, how do you think General Creech would frame the challenge facing us today if he was still alive? And what lessons do you think that General Creech would have us remember?
Yeah, just to correct the record, I was not trying to write a book. I was just trying to graduate from SAS so I could get back to the ops world so I didn't miss the war. Right. So I was, 9/11, I was a student at the School of Advanced Air Power Studies at the time. And my biggest fear was I'm going to miss the war, you know, because that was the era that I grew up in, was that, you know, we got in, we did our thing, we declared victory and we came home. And so, you know, I'm deathly afraid that I'm going to miss the war. And, you know, thankfully, I got back to the ops world in the summer of 2002, just in time to not miss the war in Afghanistan. But so I was writing this paper that turned into, you know, I don't think it's a book, but turned into a monograph, really longer than I intended. I just wanted to graduate, but it did turn into quite an effort. As you know, some interesting stories there of my relationship with General Creech.
Yeah, I understand. I understand you got a couple of phone calls from him.
Yeah, and one or two. But I think, you know, General Creech, there was a lot that I think that I learned that we all could learn from General Creech about how to approach the Air Force of 2021 in the strategic and operating environment. And so there are two things that I think I would probably highlight as things that I would confidently say that General Creech would tell us about today. The first thing General Creech would tell us, and really this is less for the airmen of the Air Force and more for kind of the external audience. General Creech, as you will recall, faced he and the other senior leaders of the Air Force faced a very active so-called defense reform movement in the late 70s and early 80s, who argued that the Air Force was buying technology that was too complex, it was too expensive, we needed quantity rather than, these exquisite capabilities. At the time, it was things like the F-117, precision-guided munitions, what later became the F-22, Lantern, all of these capabilities were things that the broader Air Force was accused of buying into too much complexity. And General Creech's point to that was, we're only building the Air Force that is as complex as it needs to be to win. You know, I mean, we're not pursuing technology for the sake of pursuing technology. We're pursuing technology because this is what it's going to take to win against our primary adversary of the time, which is the Soviet Union. And so I think we see shades of that reemerging in 2021 as we consider the recapitalization efforts and advanced technology development efforts inside the Air Force for things like the Next Generation Air Dominance Program, or perhaps the B-21 that, you know, some might question, hey, are these things really required? Are they really, you know, are we putting all our eggs in a technology basket? And I think I would say the same thing that General Creech said in the early 1980s, which was that we're only building an Air Force as complex as it needs to be to prevail in conflict with our primary adversaries. And so I think that would be the first lesson. The second lesson I think General Creech would offer us is, you know, General Creech had a profound belief in pride as the fuel of human accomplishment. And the way to engender pride across the service was by investing airmen with ownership, investing airmen with mission ownership. And you do that by decentralizing and organizing around your mission and not centralizing and elevating decision-making to increasingly higher echelons. And so, you know, there are those who would argue that we need to centralize because we get economies of scale or it's very efficient or whatever. But at the end of the day, centralization robs ownership from the airmen, which is the and takes away the pride, which is the fuel of human accomplishment. And so I think, you know, General Creech would be pounding his fist on the table, arguing against efforts to centralize and encouraging us to decentralize, empower airmen at lower levels, and become comfortable with a disaggregated Air Force where airmen at lower echelons, like your son and my son and other airmen of that generation, are empowered to go out and execute the mission without waiting for guidance from higher echelons. So So I think those are the two things that General Creech would probably counsel us on today.
Wow, that's a very powerful, and you're extracting those two key pieces. If I might say, the latter one in terms of decentralization is so important, particularly in an era as we have seen that the magic, and I'll tie this back to our discussion on RPAs, tended over the last two decades to drive decision-making away from the leading edge and folks to have to ask Mother May I before they could engage. And that kind of control is a disease. I applaud you on highlighting that decision. It's a great segue into asking you about, you talked about General Creech and his leadership lessons. Building human capital is one of the primary objectives in your AFSOC 2020 strategic guidance. So what changes are AFSOC making to its force development curriculum as you look to the future?
Yeah, not coincidentally, developing our human capital is the first of our three lines of effort in our strategic guidance that was published at the beginning of 2020 and remains relevant to us today. And so developing human capital, that comes in a host of ways, but I would kind of boil it down to three things: education, training, and experience. And we have great tools available to us to educate, train, and experience our airmen, but they've been a bit haphazard and sometimes not for purpose. And so you take an airman that has a series of assignments, a series of experiences, a series of deployments, and you look at them as a colonel and you go, well, how did these things all fit together? And what were we trying to build in terms of the development of this individual person? And, more often than not, we find ourselves almost behaving as if we were defense attorneys, where we look backwards at the fact pattern and then try and create a narrative that fits that fact pattern. And it's much more effective if you start at the front end with a vision for what it is you're trying to build and then deliberately stack the education, training, and experiences together to build the thing that you set out to build, instead of looking back from, what did we end up with at the end? And so we've got a great tool in the Air Force Special Operations School at Hurlburt that we're re-gearing many of the curriculum that we have there at the Special Operations School, focused on tactical level leadership. And we are pushing that authority and responsibility, as I just talked about, down to lower echelons. And frankly, it makes people like me and wing commanders that work for me uncomfortable, because we're not used to empowering squadron commanders and flight commanders with the authority that we envision needing to empower them with. And so we're building curriculum instruction that do that. For training, we're re-gearing our capstone exercise programs and the joint exercises that we have available for across the Special Operations Command and also the DOD, in order to specifically experience people with operating, getting training, operating in this disaggregated fashion that I talked about. And then finally, the experiencing mechanism that we're putting in place along with that. So it's all very deliberate. Underpinning this whole thing is something that I think AFSOC is probably a little out in front of the rest of the Air Force on, but I believe is fundamental to our ability to develop the force we're going to need for the future. And that is a deliberate, predictable, unit-based force generation model. And so we have really driven hard towards a unit-based force generation model, which will provide leaders at all levels the space they need to train airmen, to educate airmen, and to get some experience on airmen in order to be prepared for that future operating environment. And it is starting to pay dividends for us. And I'm really, really excited about the benefits of this. And as the Air Force continues to kind of more broadly move towards a more predictable force generation cycle to replace the system that we've been using for the last several decades, I think many of the same advantages will accrue across the rest of the Air Force.
Outstanding. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk a bit about hardware. What can you tell us about the status of the Armed Overwatch Aircraft Program? And specifically, what are the key attributes that you're looking for in an Armed Overwatch Aircraft that you don't have in your force right now? And what are some of the key milestones and associated dates?
Yeah, so the Armed Overwatch Program is proceeding apace. The Congress appropriated money in the FY21 budget for us to continue RDT&E, research, development, test, and evaluation, to conduct a flying demonstration of commercially available platforms that might meet our requirements and inform our final requirement document before we go to a procurement decision. There is some procurement money in FY21, but I don't anticipate that we would get into aircraft procurement until FY22 at the earliest. We enjoy congressional support. Clearly, there is some oversight and concern in some committees about the what is it that we envision this Armed Overwatch platform doing and what is the problem that we're trying to solve. And I would just describe it very simply as, we built a surveillance strike methodology in the mid 2005, 2006 timeframe, based on the threat that we had, with an insurgency in Iraq, a simmering insurgency in Afghanistan. And so we built this methodology for doing counter VEO operations that was very, very resource intensive. And so, as you will know from your own experience, we would frequently, over a target area, we would build a stack of airplanes, from 10,000 feet to 25,000 feet, consisting of, gunships and manned ISR and unmanned ISR and electronic warfare and CAS and fixed wing fighters, sometimes even bombers. And we would build this stack for 15,000 feet to bring air power to bear on a very discrete target on the surface of the earth. That model is not viable for the future. It's not cost effective, and it's not viable, particularly in the areas where we will be pursuing enduring counter VEO operations against adversaries that pose an external operations threat to the United States. And so the idea here, part of the national defense strategy calls on us to sustain a cost-effective, enduring counter VEO capability. And so for us to do that, we have to get out of specialized platforms stacked up for 15,000 feet over targets. And we need a platform. We need to collapse the stack, if you will, into a smaller number of platforms. And that's where this Armed Overwatch capability comes in, where it's going to have some reconfigurable ISR capability. When needed, it will be able to provide CAS procedures in support of ground forces. And so it's really a multi-role airplane that's capable of operating with a very light logistics footprint in small disaggregated teams, once again, as we were talking about, in very austere regions. And so that type of capability is what we intend to demonstrate this year and then move along in the acquisition process following that. But the first step really is getting to a flying demonstration, which we anticipate is going to take place in the coming months.
Very good. A bit of a follow-up. Will the U-28 continue to fill its unique niche and complement the Armed Overwatch aircraft? I understand that the U-28 just went over 600,000 combat hours. I was curious if you anticipate any service life issues.
So right now, we're not at a crisis in terms of service life on the U-28, but we can see it from here. We've put a lot of hours on our U-28 platforms. And so we understand that, you know, we are going to have to decide what to do about this. And the U-28 is an incredibly capable manned ISR platform. But again, like the rest of that stack of airplanes, it is basically a single role platform. And so as we think about the future of the combination of ISR and fire support for small teams on the ground, the U-28, we anticipate as the Armed Overwatch platform comes online, our current planning shows us drawing down the U-28 as the Armed Overwatch platform comes online. And so there is a phased transition there, but at the end of the day, the Armed Overwatch platform will be less expensive to operate. It will be more versatile than the U-28, and frankly, we'll have greater capacity to operate in those small disaggregated kind of teams as we've talked about.
Well, very good. Let's switch back to AFSOC's 2020 strategic guidance. One of the goals in there is to develop a comprehensive data strategy that provides airmen with a baseline knowledge of data science and artificial intelligence. Could you elaborate on why this is such an important objective, and what would a data strategy for AFSOC look like?
Yeah, so, that's an area where I probably should have been more demanding in terms of how we wrote that in our strategic guidance. Because at the end of the day, I don't think there is such a thing as a data strategy. I think there is data in support of your strategy. You know, this is much like communications. I don't really believe in a communication strategy. I just believe communicating in support of the strategy. And so, you know, if you go back to where we started on the strategic guidance, it is an airman-centric document. Our airmen are our competitive advantage. And as we lay out these three lines of effort, all centered around our airmen, the question with respect to data is how do we leverage the power of data and AI in order to enable airmen to be more effective in this future operating environment? So whether it's our, you know, CV-22 maintainers who maintain a very maintenance-intensive platform, and they need predictive analytics that will help them understand the health of the aircraft and what parts are going to fail. Predictive logistics that we can send the parts forward as we predict that they will be needed. This is an area where SOCOM has done some pretty groundbreaking work, and AFSOC is leveraging the larger SOCOM effort on this. But that's an example. Another example of this is clearly in our intelligence enterprise. We have some of the most talented airmen in AFSOC are spent doing, solving a problem that you tried to solve during your time in uniform, which is the full motion video analytics. And, you know, having incredibly talented and bright airmen looking at a TV screen, counting the number of people walking in and out of a building is not work that airmen ought to be doing. And so how do we leverage AI in order to free up airmen to do the things that only an airman can do? If a machine can do it, we ought to let the machine do it, perhaps with human supervision, but the humans ought to be doing what only the humans can do. And so really, you know, and again, our human capital, developing the human capital is kind of that first line of effort that we talk about. So how does data play into developing our human capital? Well, you know, there are reams and reams of data around every course that I've attended, you know, my ability or not to speak a foreign language, my assignment history. All of this is data. And so when you think about how do we decide who the right airman is for this particular important assignment we have available? Being able to leverage the power of data to manage our human capital is something we need to get our arms around. And so wherever you go, you know, data is not the problem of the chief data officer. Data is all of our problem. And so that's really what I would say about that. This is an area where the Department of Defense broadly has work to do. There's some exciting developments underway, and AFSOC's trying to stay on the leading edge of that.
Very good. Now, last year, AFSOC collaborated with the Air Force Research Lab on a demo of the palletized munitions concept for the air battle management system. What value does AFSOC bring to the development of ABMS and JADC2 concepts of operation?
Well, like I alluded to a little earlier, you know, AFSOC as a innovation and experimentation platform for the Air Force makes a lot of sense. So, you know, AFSOC can leverage SOCOM acquisition authorities, limited SOCOM resourcing, a streamlined requirements process available to us wearing our, you know, Air Force component of SOCOM hat. And we can leverage those things wearing our Air Force MAGCOM hat on behalf of the rest of the Air Force. And so, for example, last year, when the acquisition executive was talking about, hey, we, you know, really ought to look at palletized munitions and how to move quickly on this, you know, my thought was, hey, you know, if only there was a MAGCOM somewhere in the Air Force that had some experience turning cargo airplanes into munitions delivery platforms, you know, wouldn't that be fantastic? Oh, wait, we have that. It's called AFSOC. You know, we built the AC-130 gunship. And so, you know, this is in our DNA. And so I said, hey, look, we'd be happy to demonstrate this capability to you. And literally, we were dropping hardware out of the back of airplanes, literally inside of 2 months. And when it came time to do a in-flight retargeting demonstration as part of the ABMS effort that you alluded to, of course, why wouldn't we want to do that? If we can help the Air Force develop concepts and technology that will be relevant to the future operating environment, that's beneficial to the Air Force. And SOCOM accrues benefit from that as well, because, you know, I firmly believe that the SOCOM service components are most effective for SOF when we're closest to our parent service. And so for me, I am always aware of the fact that the first part of AFSOC is AF. And so if I can draw as close as possible to my parent service, that's good for SOCOM and it's good for the Air Force.
Very good. Let's move to a different part of the world and talk a bit about Air Force Special Ops role in combating terrorism and extremism in East and West Africa. As the U.S. in total kind of reorients toward an era of near peer competition, what role do you think AFSOC is going to play on the African continent as we move forward?
Well, it's hard to say without supposing what the new administration priorities are going to be and this type of thing. So the short answer is I don't know, but I would suggest to you that if we want to maintain pressure on those violent extremist organizations that pose a threat to the United States, that pose a threat to the homeland, we may need to remain engaged in portions of Africa against very specific threats and not just broadly anywhere there's an extremist, but specifically where those that pose an external threat are. And, you know, when you go back to our armed overwatch conversation, what is the nature of our engagement look like? What do we think that is going to look like? And what I would envision is a light footprint, a multi-role capability that has the ability to provide the intelligence needed to remain aware of the threat and to take action where necessary, and has a kinetic capability to take action when necessary without drawing a lot of attention to our host nations that may be hosting those operations. That is what the future looks like in my mind. And so, you know, the armed Overwatch platform, would be ideally suited for that type of an operational environment.
Very good. Thank you for that. Now, Air Force statistics published last year found a shortfall in the number of special ops pilots between 2015 and 19. What does the AFSOC pilot manning situation look like today, if you could bring us up to speed on that? And how do you plan to resource training to ensure that you all have the pilot capacity to meet your challenges tomorrow?
Yeah, so this is a complex issue with a lot of different tentacles. And, I'm sure the audience would love to hear me talk about absorption and experiencing and, you know, white jets and, you know, all the various parts of the white of the aircrew management problem. But suffice it to say that AFSOC is a customer of the Air Force undergraduate flying training pipeline, just like every other MAGCOM in the Air Force. AFSOC absorbs a number of new pilots every year, and our ability to absorb those new pilots is really governed by our training enterprise. And so if we grow our training enterprise, to get the throughput that we need into our squadrons, to fully man our squadrons, then that means we need to invest in the training enterprise. And so part of what we're doing going forward, and this is part of our strategic guidance, is fully resourcing our training enterprise. We have assumed risk in our formal training enterprise over the last 20 years in order to maximize the capacity that we could deploy forward. But now is the time to reset that and to bring that more in balance. And so I am happy to contribute more instructors to the undergraduate training enterprise. I'm happy to contribute more instructors and more platforms to the formal training unit instruction capacity of the Air Force enterprise. And I'm happy to absorb more new pilots as they come in, new crews, frankly. It's more than just pilots. But the interesting thing is that AFSOC retention is actually above the Air Force average. And so, you contrast the Air Force's most heavily deployed MAGCOM with the fact that our retention is actually better than most parts of the Air Force. You know, how does that happen? What does that tell us? And what I believe it tells us is there is a lot of pride in AFSOC. I think airmen feel like what they do matters, and they want to stick around and be a part of something important. And so as we think about our transformation for the future, that's what I intend to build on, is the fact that people like being part of something that matters. They like having mission ownership. As we push down authority and responsibility to lower levels, it's interesting. In AFSOC, we hear young officers and NCOs clamoring for more. And outside of AFSOC, we hear some that tell us, well, you can't give them more responsibility. They're going to, that's going to drive a retention issue, because, you know, one of the primary complaints of people as they get out of the Air Force are too many additional duties. And, you know, my response to that is leadership is not an additional duty. You know, leadership, people want to lead. People want responsibility. They want to be accountable. And so as we push more and more responsibility and authority to our young officers, what we find is they are absolutely hungry for all of that. And so our retention is pretty good. And I anticipate that it will continue to be good as long as we can show airmen that what they do matters as part of AFSOC.
Excellent. Well, unfortunately, we've now come to the end of this segment of our discussion. And General Slife, thanks again for your insightful comments and for sharing your valuable perspectives on Air Force Special Operations. Now, as an alert to our listeners, next week, the Mitchell Institute will be hosting a number of live and on-demand panels with top Air Force leaders as part of this year's virtual aerospace warfare symposium. So we'll hope you'll join us. Now you can check it out at online and search for Aerospace Warfare Symposium 2021 or afa.org. All right, Jim, we're now going to open up the session to our questions from our audience members who've been listening to the conversation. And just as a reminder for our listeners, when you're called on, please announce your name and the organization you're with and use that raise hand function on your device or send in via chat your questions. So we'll get started right off the bat with Valerie and Senna. Valerie?
Hey, thank you so much for doing this, General. I had a question about armed overwatch. So Congress in the NDAA and the Defense Appropriations Bill, you know, last year, they prohibited SOCOM from being able to buy any armed overwatch aircraft. And then they also decreased the funding quite a bit to around 21 million. I was wondering, you know, how big of a deal is that in your mind? And are you concerned at all about a lack of congressional support for the program?
Yeah, so the reduction in funding, the way the program was initially laid out, would have resulted in procurement, because again, I think SOCOM envisions a commercially available platform. So in other words, a non-developmental type of capability. And so I think SOCOM had envisioned this for to begin acquisition in 2022. And so I'm sorry, 2021. I've got, you know, there's so many budgets and POMs floating around. It's hard to keep straight where we are. Congress wanted to see more of what came out of the demonstration. And so the money that was funded in 2021, I think is a little more than what you indicated, but your point is valid. That money is fully sufficient to do the demonstration program that SOCOM asked to do. And we anticipate going back for further conversation with Congress about that before initiating acquisition on the backside of a demonstration program that should take place here in the coming months. And so to the point of your question, am I concerned about it? So I think Congress is appropriately and prudently exercising their oversight role. I think I would view this as a lower risk enterprise than perhaps some charged with oversight do, but the fact that we see it differently doesn't mean that they're wrong. I mean, I respect that. Am I concerned about a lack of support? I'm actually not, and of course it varies across the committees. I mean, some are more supportive than others, but I think Congress is being prudent about this. But ultimately, I believe that SOCOM will be able to demonstrate to the Congress that this is a viable program and it's required for the future operating environment. So I remain cautiously optimistic. I certainly don't want to take anything for granted with respect to congressional support or frankly the support of the new administration. But I do believe that. That the Armed Overwatch program makes sense, and I look forward to continuing to talk about it with interested parties, both in the administration and also on the Hill.
Okay, a gentleman who's had his hand raised for a long time, Garrett Rhyme.
Hi, General, thank you. My question is about the contract that was just announced for the Silent Arrow cargo glider. To downsize it so it could fit into the CV-22 or other small fixed-wing aircraft. What's the thinking behind trying to deploy this this glider from the CV-22 or a small fixed-wing aircraft, as opposed to trying to, you know, drop it out of the back of a C-130? And what sort of missions would be enabled with these other aircraft?
Yeah, so got to admit that I'm not familiar with the details of that program. I know that in general, our approach has been, you know, to proliferate these capabilities to platforms as broadly as we can. And so the CV-22 has a robust overseas presence in both Europe and also in the Indo-Pacific region. And so anything we can do to broaden the capabilities of those platforms. So if you go back to the analogy that I was using earlier about the, you know, kitchen, the V-22 is a fantastic set of groceries that we have in our kitchen, but we need to maybe buy a few condiments to make it relevant, more relevant to the future operating environment. So this would be an example of that. But in terms of the specifics of that exact contract, I'm not tracking it.
All right, let's turn now to Marcus Weisgerber.
Hey, thanks, Dave, and thanks, General, for doing this. Also on Armed Overwatch, I got just a few rapid fire ones for you. Are you looking only at one type of aircraft? Are you open to leasing aircraft? And what, I guess, is the soonest you would like to have these aircraft on the ramp? Thanks.
Yeah, so when you say, are we looking at only one type of aircraft, we're not. We're looking at a handful of aircraft that we think would all be capable to meet the mission requirement. And, you know, it's without having done the demos, it's preliminary to say whether what an acquisition program would look like, whether it would look like a single platform, or whether it would look like multiple platforms, or whether leasing might be part of that. We're too far out from that. So we need to get through this demo to see what industry can produce at low risk in a short order. In terms of the timeline on it, we were ready to go in 21. Congress wanted to take a harder look at this, which I completely understand. And we're going through that now. But I would like to be in a procurement sometime in fiscal year 22. And so I think we can do that at relatively low risk based on what we've seen from the vendors who have indicated that they intend to bring platforms to demonstrate for us in the coming months. I think we could easily meet a 22 procurement decision. So that's really what I would be looking for.
A quick follow-up. Are you looking at stuff from, I guess, the range of a armed caravan to a Super Tucano, AT-6, Scorpion, all that stuff, anything more or less?
If it is non-developmental and it meets the requirements that SOCOM has laid out to industry, then we're interested in looking at it. And so, that general class of airplanes is about right. The key thing that I would offer is, this is not a rehash of the Air Force light attack program. I think SOCOM envisions this as more of a multi-role platform that can perform level delivery of precision munitions. And so, it's not in our DNA, at least not in 2021. It was in the 1960s and early 1970s, but it's not in our DNA in the Air Force Special Operations Command to fly fighter type aircraft. And I don't want to get into that line of work because, frankly, it would just exacerbate the problem the Air Force has with fighter pilot manning more broadly. And so I think we can meet the requirement with a level delivery precision munition kind of platform.
Thank you.
Okay, let's turn to Yasmin.
Hi, sir. Thank you so much for doing this. I have two questions, but the first one is an Armed Overwatch question. So there have been some critics in the past who have said that the platforms that you guys are looking at are not survivable in great power competition, that they really could only be used in like a region like Africa. Do you agree with that? And then my second question is, it's a bit of a departure, but I know the services have been rolling out Arctic strategies recently. How do you view AFSOC's role in the Arctic, and what kind of capabilities do you need to operate in that region? Thank you.
Yeah, so I think you know, to the former point about the armed overwatch platform not being survivable, clearly we're not trying to build an armed overwatch platform that, you know, would be in a contested first world IADS kind of environment. I mean, if we wanted to do that, the armed overwatch platform would be the F-35. And the whole reason we're doing this is because the National Defense Strategy talks about the need to do cost-effective counter VEO operations, cost-effective irregular warfare. And so, the operating environment where we currently operate U-28s is about the same operating environment where we would envision operating armed overwatch platforms. You know, it doesn't have an ejection seat, right? No airplane in AFSOC has an ejection seat. You know, if we're trying to fly airplanes that require ejection seats, we're probably focused on the wrong thing as the Air Force component of SOCOM. So I think that it is, as envisioned, it is survivable enough to operate in the environment that we anticipate it operating in. I think that's how I would answer that. With respect to the Arctic, you know, we've done a lot of work in the Arctic, particularly in some of our forward station units. And so we've learned some valuable lessons. There is some great innovation taking place at the unit level on Arctic operations. You know, we're operating in Europe in the very high north, well above the Arctic Circle. And our airmen are innovating in terms of aircraft capabilities, the mobility platforms that operate in that kind of an environment, and how to get those on and off our aircraft, cold weather gear for operators and maintainers of those platforms. Our special tactics operators are learning some valuable lessons. You know, sometimes communication in very high latitudes can be challenging. And so we've learned some valuable lessons about radios and our ability to transmit voice and data over long distances. And so we're learning all these lessons. We're not planning to operate in the Arctic. We are operating in the Arctic. We're learning every day and improving our capability to do more.
Thank you.
All right, Frank Wolf.
Yeah. Hi, General. Just wondering if you could speak a little bit about, AFSOC's top unfunded requirements and how you see those evolving, and whether there's still a plan next year for the test of the AC-130J laser, offensive laser, what that's going to involve, what types of targets, that kind of thing.
Yeah, in terms of AFSOC's top unfunded requirements, I'm going to defer on that for the time being, because I don't want to get out in front of either the Air Force or SOCOM in terms of talking about what our unfunded requirements are going forward. What I will say about that is that Congress provided the Air Force with funding last year in the 21 budget for two CV-22 aircraft, which really will be useful to us in the sense that at our training base at Kirtland, there are a couple of pre-production CV-22s that are configured unlike any of the other aircraft in the fleet. And so they're very difficult to maintain. And because they're not configured the same, we can't rotate them through the operational fleet. And so Congress provided funding for two additional CV-22s that we intend to use to standardize the fleet on the production configuration of those platforms. So that was good news for us that Congress took an interest in that one. That's about as much as I'd care to say about the unfunded requirements. Was there a second part of the question that
I was wondering about the that AC-130J, that laser demonstration that was supposed to, I guess, happen next year, if that's still going forward, and what kind of, you know, offensive capability would you be able to demonstrate with that and get ground targets?
Yeah, so that, yes, it is still proceeding. So it is that test is still proceeding. So we have, an aircraft undergoing modification to accept that. And so, when we get the results of that demonstration, I think we'll have a much better idea for the use cases for that. So, there are a lot of variables that make employing a laser from an aircraft challenging, atmospheric dispersion, target size, heat, power, all those things become very, very challenging. And so when we see what the demonstrated capability actually is, I think we'll be in a better position to decide whether it has a place in the gunship fleet going forward. So I'm looking forward to seeing the demonstration next year. Thanks for the question.
Thanks.
General Slife, we've come to the end of our time, but I've got two more hands up. Do you have time to take on two more questions?
I would usually say no, but sir, since it's you that's asking, of course I will.
Okay, thanks. Jennifer Lee, you're next.
Hi, sir. Thank you so much for taking the time, General, and thank you so much for hosting this event, General Deptula. My question is, I was hoping that you might be able to tell us how, if at all, the service's growing focus on agile combat employment is changing the way that you train your operators.
Well, I'm not sure if somebody planted that, but I'm really glad that that question came up. So this is a great example of what I was talking about earlier with respect to building small teams focused around the mission. In my entire career, I have never once fielded a phone call from Central Command asking for us to quickly deploy the contracting squadron or quickly deploy the logistics readiness squadron. And this is an area where our garrison organizational construct for our support functions is not aligned to the way we actually employ these capabilities in combat. And so the problem statement for us is how do you build and force generate combat support capabilities that are ready to operate in that future operating environment in a method that isn't based on our current home station garrison construct. And so this is a place where AFSOC is really putting a lot of effort right now, and we've got a pilot effort going on at one of our bases right now, where we are assuming risk in some installation support functions to build a small multifunctional team of airmen that will go through a force generation cycle and a deployment cycle together with the operating forces. In a way that is representative of what we think the future operating environment might require. So envision a small unit of airmen where the forklift driver knows how to run Cat 5 cable for your communication suite, and your generator electrician knows how to stand guard at the perimeter of your small forward operating base. This type of multifunctional team-based organization is really what I think the future of mission support is going to look like. And so we're pretty excited about the work we're doing in that regard. But thanks for highlighting that one.
You're welcome. And sir, could you possibly elaborate which base that trial run is happening at?
I could, but I'm not going to because I don't want to put those airmen in a spotlight. I want them to be able to experiment, to learn lessons. If we don't get it right the first time, I want to give them freedom to do that without, the bright spotlight of people staring at them, to see if they were successful or not. I'm 100% confident we're going to be successful. I just, I don't know whether it'll be this year or the second cycle after we learn from the first one.
Thank you.
All right. Last but not least, Oriana.
Thanks so very much. So to wrap up the aircraft discussion, sir, I believe it was in 2018, AFSOC was conducting an analysis of alternative study to look at alternatives for its manned ISR, but also looking at the broad range of aircraft that fit the AFSOC model. And of course, you today talked about that might soon incorporate armed overwatch. I'm curious what became of that study and what its findings were, and how is it shaping what you're looking at for your next generation ISR as well as armed overwatch? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So it is absolutely one of the things that is kind of shaping the way we think about the future of single role platforms, and you know, do we need a kinetic capability organic to all of our ISR platforms of the future, or can, you know, how much of it should be manned, how much of it should be unmanned? It absolutely is informing all of that. But you know, analyses of alternatives, of course, are all snapshots in time, and I think you know, we have a clearer picture today of what the future is going to require of us than we did in the past. And so I don't want to get out in front of things that SOCOM and the Air Force haven't sorted out internally yet. But I would tell you that I think that there is a lot of room for partnership between SOCOM and the Air Force on ISR for the future. And it doesn't necessarily have to revolve around who owns what. You know, we tend to fix bayonets around the issue of ownership. And I think we don't have to do that. I think there is a lot of room for partnership here in a way that provides advantages to both SOCOM and the Air Force. And so that analysis of alternatives, it absolutely informed the requirements document as it evolved for the requirements document as it evolved for the armed overwatch platform. But it is one of several data points. But thanks for the question on that.
Well, thank you, General Slife, for extending your time. We have come to the end of this Aerospace Nation event. And thanks again for taking the time to do this. So to you and our audience, from all of us here at the Mitchell Institute, have a great aerospace power kind of day.
Thanks, General Deptula. Good to see you.
You bet. Have a safe flight back.
Thank you.